The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton for the stay.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. As always, up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton back again to talk about the week that was in the world of Formula One. And Mark, boy, just like I guess Formula One is the microcosm of the global macrocosm, in as much as there's been a lot going on just everywhere, just generally, and that has been exactly the same situation in Formula One since we did the show roughly a week ago. It's and I've been so busy just with everything else, with family, with work, and just trying to navigate through the maze of life, that it kind of really snuck up and caught me. Like, when I started going through the news the last couple of days, I'm like, whoa, wait, what? It's just like, I've really missed something over the past several days.
I got your agenda a couple of minutes ago before we started this podcast, and I have to say I had a bit of a heart attack. It's a very ambitious agenda to work through today, and I would never have expected there would be so much to talk about in the middle of January. It's a little bit alarming, but there's obviously some really, really good stuff here, and I think we were maybe a little bit ahead of the curve last week when we were talking about some of our subjects, especially around the calendar. I think we were kind of leading into some things that really kind of blew up this week in terms of newsworthiness. So yeah, lots to get into. I had not that people particularly care about my personal life, but we had very good Persian takeout tonight. So I am amped up and ready to go here.
Well, we're going to have to talk off air because, anytime I hear something like that, you know, that's an insider's tip and I just need to, I need more detail. So we're going to talk after the show, my friend. But yeah, you know, it's really interesting about some of the things we were talking about. One thing I feel like there's this cloud of shame hanging over me that we really missed one of the big stories that was kind of like right in there between the lines last week when we were sitting there in the, I guess MotoGP corner is going to be a thing. Anyways, we were talking about how, you know, that the sort of tie into Alpine and all these appointments that they've been making, and the writing was on the wall that Abitbol, like, where was he going to end up? I mean, we'll get into that a little bit later in the show, but I feel like we completely glanced over it and neither of us picked up on it, and lo and behold, that's one of the stories this week, that Cyril Abitbol, who's been team principal at Renault for the past couple of years, has left the team effective immediately.
Yeah, that was pretty to be totally honest, I think that was pretty incompetent of both of us that we were discussing in strategic detail the acquisition of their new CEO from a very successful MotoGP team, and at no point did we make any reference or make any consideration to what the impact could have been or already was to their long-standing team principal. So yeah, shame on us for missing that one.
Well, you know, we haven't even got to preseason testing yet, so this will be our one. This will be our gimme. So we've been put on notice, Mark. We're going to have to be a lot sharper on these things moving forward. But big story number one is that Ferrari driver Charles Leclerc has tested positive for COVID, following up not even a week after McLaren driver Lando Norris announced that he did tested positive after losing smell and taste and experiencing mild symptoms when he was heading out for a short holiday in Abu Dhabi before he was going to do what he needed to do there. Charles reporting similar. He wrote in a release, quote, "Hello guys, I hope you're all staying safe. I want to let you know that I have tested positive for COVID-19. I am regularly checked according to my team's protocols. Unfortunately, I learned I have been in contact with a positive case and immediately went into self-isolation, notifying anyone I had contact with. A subsequent test I took has come back positive. I am feeling okay and have mild symptoms. I will remain in isolation in my home in Monaco in compliance with the regulations set forth by the local health authorities. Stay safe and take care." So he's what now, the eighth driver, I believe, that I guess it's not eighth.
I think that's fifth. So fifth. We did the math last week, right?
Yeah,
so it
yeah.
was, well, it's it gotta was be fifth. Sergio, yeah. Lance, Lewis, Lando, and now Leclerc.
Leclerc.
But so. even, even that is pretty remarkable, right? You talk about a 20 driver field and a quarter of your field has tested positive for COVID-19. Yeah. I think, unfortunately, I can't even say that most of that wasn't during the season, because three of those cases were during the season as a whole, but that's pretty alarming. And, you know, my concern, and this is just purely speculation, is we know that that Charles is a younger driver. He obviously enjoys his social life. And I think there was some criticism of him early in the season last year, when between the two races in Austria, he'd left the F1 bubble and flown home to Monaco to spend time with friends and family. And he was greatly criticized. But I just got to think that the teams themselves would have mandated that these drivers would have been in protective bubbles for the offseason. Like, guys, I know it's painful. We're paying you especially in Charles Leclerc's case, we're paying you tens of millions of dollars a year to drive our car. Please, please just stay in your home. And again, we don't have any of the specific details here. He seemed to be humble enough. You know what? The team's protocols caught this early. It's all good news. But it is a little bit alarming that a quarter of the drivers have now tested positive in the last year.
Yeah, it certainly is interesting. Due to the fact that we were just talking about it a couple of weeks ago, that I think it was Ross Braun, the motorsport director of, or director general of motorsport, or whatever his fancy title is. I trip over it every time I mention it.
So do I.
But, he released some of the numbers, and all the tens of thousands of COVID tests that they did over the course of the 2020 World Championship, what was it, like 75, 78, less than 80 cases came back as positive, and the vast majority were just unfortunately related to the ancillary personnel and people that work at the facilities and the tracks and stuff like that. So the people actually in the teams that actually tested positive was actually quite small. But then, you know, when you kind of divide it up into the different areas of people that have contracted and gotten COVID inside the Formula One sphere, you know, a quarter of the grid, that's actually quite astonishing. So I haven't heard anything about Lando. I'm just assuming no news is good news. And the same with Charles. And, but, you know, neither has Lance really said anything, or Lewis or Checo. I mean, they all kind of reported mild symptoms and whatnot. So hopefully with these two, it's the case. But as it seems to be reported most of the time, that when it comes to, you know, your younger person in healthy and good shape, that it tends to be, you know, something that you recover from, and the lingering after effects don't seem to be as severe as it has been for other people. But definitely that was a bit of a shocker when I saw that this week. And, you know, the first thing that popped into my mind after, I was like, oh my God, you know, Charles has got COVID now, was just like, who's going to be next? So I guess it's just going to be a fact of life that we're going to have to deal with as we go through this, navigate this whole COVID thing over the weeks and months, and hopefully not years ahead. So, Mark, you mentioned it right off the start, how we were just discussing last week, you know, this ambitious 23 race calendar that Formula One is trying to push forward this year. Is, you know, we're still in January. We're still, well, you know, quite a ways away from the, you know, the wishful start to the season that they'd project or aim for in the middle of March. You know, that's been now confirmed that Australia will not take place in the traditional time slot in the middle of March. It's going to be moved to December. China's pushing for something too, that they want to be rescheduled to the end of the year. Imola's been added to the calendar. And, you know, we're going to have to deal with stories of people within the Formula One bubble testing positive with COVID. So, over the weeks and months ahead, that until things settle down, that that this is just going to be a fact of life, and that despite they wanted to push forward this very ambitious schedule, that it really isn't too much of a surprise, and hopefully that you know, we don't lose too many races. I mean, rescheduling is one thing, but I hope too many don't disappear altogether.
Right. And I feel like we were in a pretty good place last week when we started talking, and I think in part really speculating about what the calendar could look like this year. And the consequence, at least the early consequence, was that Liberty was pretty confident, I think, when the calendar was posted originally, that we were going to be able to start the season in mid-March in Australia. I think anyone that's close to the ground in that country recognized that that was never going to be a reality. So Australia officially has been displaced from its typical opening March time slot. I think at this point, And again, there'll probably be some movement in the calendar. We can probably expect to see it slotted between Brazil and Saudi Arabia in a very unusual November time slot. But the good news is, and you know, I'll let you kind of break the news on this one, because I'm sure most of our listeners haven't heard this, but we are going to be going back to a track in the middle of April that I think both you and I really enjoyed last year, right?
Yeah, well, Imola is a great one. I really enjoyed the race there. I mean, it was quite eventful, and it was really kind of cool. Like, you know, most people know that I'm a cyclist, and, you know, I really enjoy watching, you know, especially like the grand tours and a lot of the classics and things like that. And it was really cool to kind of get a preview because they had the world championships at Imola. And, you know, for the road races, they used part of the circuits. They were going back to front, but still, it was kind of a cool little preview and tie-in. But I am glad to see that that Imola will be back for the 2021 season. So the way that it's shaking down right now, so obviously Australia's out. The start of the season's been shifted 2 weeks till 28th of March for Bahrain. Then we get a couple of weeks in between. Then we're back to Imola, 2nd of May. That's still an open time slot. And then after that, we have Spain, Monaco, Azerbaijan, Canada, France, Austria, British Grand Prix, 18th of July. And then first half of the season, should it you know, complete the way that it's supposed to, we'll finish up at in Hungary at the first weekend of August. And then we're into the summer break, because then, you know, we got 3.5 weeks off, and then we go to Spa for the 29th. So like you mentioned, Australia is now slotted in for the 21st of November, and it seems kind of weird for us to see it at that time of year. But I mean, from a weather point of view, I mean, in the Southern Hemisphere, the data definitely works. And certainly I'm glad to see that it's sticking around. And, you know, looking at this new re-released calendar that Formula One released this week, I really, really, really are crossing both fingers, all my fingers, all my toes, that that this stays the way that it is. But, you know, I've still gone back and thought about it, you know, over the weeks since the end of last season, that sure, it was disappointing and understandable that we lost so many races. But ultimately, by the time we got racing, started racing at Austria in the beginning of July, we went through the entire season, wrapped up at Abu Dhabi in the beginning of December, it still felt like a really healthy season. I don't feel like it really lacked at all. I mean, we had a lot of double and triple header, you know, portions of the calendars, which obviously is exhausting for the people in Formula One, for the teams and the drivers and everything. But, you know, certainly if we were to lose a couple of races off here again, and like I say, hopefully that doesn't happen. Still, I think anywhere if we get 17, 18 races, hopefully that is the, you know, the bare minimum. And it doesn't really sound as though that we're going to lose too many, but, you know, it worked. And anything that we get more this year, I think, is just the cherry on the top of the cake.
Yeah, the good news, of course, for the race organizers in Saudi Arabia, in Australia, is of course, by putting that race at the back half of the schedule, at the back half of the calendar and into November, there's every reason to think that, again, knock on wood, everything goes well, that the vast majority, if not the entire population of Australia, should be vaccinated by that point, and you should be able to sell all available tickets. And I'm sure there's going to be some health authority guidance on distancing and safety protocols that we haven't seen in the past. But the good news is for the race organizers, they're actually going to be able to recover some of the costs associated with hosting this. And I think one of the things, and you know, I was having some sidebar conversations during the week with somebody that's a little bit closer to the sport, but kind of works on the financial side. And he was saying that one of the underreported stories through all of this is what COVID potentially is doing to the individual race organizers that host some of these races. And as much as we talk about the impact of Formula One and the teams and Liberty and the sponsors, the individual organizations that host these races are getting absolutely battered. And the tracks that host these races often rely on the revenues associated with those events to fund the maintenance of the infrastructure. So hopefully, again, by the back half of this calendar, things will return to normal. We'll be able to start selling some tickets and things like that. I'm still very skeptical about Canada and Monaco in the front half of the schedule, and really Azerbaijan. I think that those, given that they're really located within metro limits, I think are going to be problematic.
It seems shaky, yeah.
But I think the other positive thing, though, is obviously we're going to start in Bahrain, which makes total sense. I think we're going to speak to preseason testing in a minute. Imola is going to be awesome. I can't wait to see that. Whether there's fans there or not, it's just a beautiful track to see. And then I think the other open slot, which was it was kind of left in place, I think, by Formula One, because I think they understood there needed to be some flexibility in the calendar this year. Is after Vietnam dropped off, they didn't backfill it. But I think there's every reason to believe that Portimão, Portugal, could still fill that slot. And I think you and I did the math last week that even geographically, it just makes sense to have a Portugal race immediately preceding a Spanish Grand Prix simply because of geography. But I think the calendar will continue to move. But to kind of mirror, echo your point as well, I at no point did I think that anything about last year was anything less than a championship. To me, no, it was 17 races. Yeah. It was a full-on championship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the things that they were talking about last spring before they got to the point where it was finalized that we knew that we were going to have X number of races to start the season, and there are going to be more races to added to sort of fatten up the end portion of the calendar. They were saying that they needed a minimum, of 8 races to just in the laws or the rules to actually have or constitute a world championship. Now, that would have seemed pretty thin, you know, in terms of races, but I think at one point when it was looking so dire and so grim, I think many people said, okay, for that, what it takes to get the championship done without having to wash out an entire season, so be it. I mean, the fact that they got 17 races in was absolutely, phenomenal work. But I was just looking at this revised calendar, Mark, and certainly if things stay the same right now, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got that really far off race in the Middle East and Bahrain to start the season on 28 March. Then you have Imola, 2nd May, potentially Portimão. Then you have Spain, Monaco, Azerbaijan at the beginning of June. So certainly, you know, you get some hopping around within Europe and towards the fringes of Europe before popping over to Canada for the one-off race in the European season before you go back to Paul Ricard at the end of June. So certainly it's going to be fluid at the moment. And I think we just have to sit back and be patient and see where the calendar develops from here. Anyways, it's time to take a quick break here on the Overtime Media Network. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment because we're going to talk about what we all want to talk about in Formula One, and that's lawsuits. That's what we're all here for, right? No, maybe not. Anyways, don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. Welcome to everybody listening in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And those of you watching on YouTube, I appreciate you all spending some time with us this week again. And Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton, running down the latest news in Formula One. And as I just hinted to before the break, so we're having a little bit of drama in Brazil. So a judge has actually suspended the contract between the promoter of the Brazilian Grand Prix, or what they're calling the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, which is at Interlagos. I mean, same venue, same place. There's been for a long time. So the judge has actually intervened and suspended the contract. And this is basically regarding the use of public funds to secure the race and then transparency and all these sorts of things. And rightly so. I mean, if there's been some issue and it's not completely above board, then, you know, the public has a right to know how, you know, public funds are being spent on these things. So it's kind of hot on the tails of the news that came out a month ago when F1 CEO Chase Carey announced that they just signed a new 5-year deal with Interlagos to keep the Brazilian Grand Prix there for the next several years. So interesting that it should turn out this way. So, you know, like we were talking about before the break, obviously there's a lot in flux, but honestly, when this news came out this week, I've been expecting to hear about races being canceled or rescheduled because of COVID and all the logistical problems and public health measures that are in play that are going to be at the forefront of everybody's mind. So to see this, Sao Paulo being canceled, or not canceled, but suspended, this whole thing. Well, I mean, it's not suspended, but it's on a little bit of uneven ground at the moment. So we'll wait and see how it plays out, but not one I was expecting to see, my friend.
No, and Brazil's been a bit of a mystery and a challenge for Formula One for a number of years. And to backtrack a little bit, Interlagos and the previous race organizers had a really sweet deal with Bernie and F1. For all intents and purposes, they were basically paying zero in terms of race hosting fees. That was something that Liberty was eager to get away from, and Interlagos race organizers didn't have the appetite to shift away from. And Formula One and Chase Carey and Liberty started working very closely with a separate group in Rio, because the plan was to build an entirely new track in Rio, and they were to pay Formula One a very, very, very healthy hosting fee. That fell apart for a whole host of reasons: corruption, challenges from environmental groups because they were going to build the track on an environmentally sensitive area. It was a mess. So ultimately, Formula One went back to Interlagos. They partnered with a new race organizer who, incidentally, is actually backed by the Abu Dhabi government. As part of the agreement, the city of Sao Paulo was willing to contribute, I think, about $4 million US towards the cause. And now the plan was all of that money is supposed to go into kind of track upgrades. But I think we've seen the shift in Europe, at least, that GPs are being named more after the regions and the cities that host them as opposed to the country. And I think there's also some sour feelings in Sao Paulo and at Interlagos about the fact that Rio was so close to ripping this event away from them on a permanent basis. So yeah, to your point, the judges suspended the contract between Liberty and Formula One, citing a lack of transparency with basically what are effectively public funds that the city itself was going to contribute to the event. So we'll ultimately see how this turns out. I'm sure for the sake of $4 million, something's going to get worked out, but it's also good to see in a country that has been so criticized, and rightly so, for the use of public funds, whether it was the World Cup or the Summer Olympics, that there's some accountability kind of at a legal level. But I don't think there's going to be anything consequential in terms of risk to the race happening.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to follow. But, the whole issue of transparency and the use of public funds really kind of reminded me a lot of the discussion around the Mexican Grand Prix. This is actually pre-COVID.
Oh, yeah.
For the same thing, that there was a real, I don't want to say like massive pushback, but there was definitely, voices, being made within the public about the use of public funds to try and retain and keep the Mexican Grand Prix at Autodromo Hermanos Rodriguez. And apologies for my very, very bad Spanish pronunciation, but so be it. But it's just also interesting what you're saying about how you're seeing a lot of these races now being rebranded to the specific region rather than the country as a whole. And I wonder if this might be a bit of a phenomenon that we might see in this COVID and hopefully soon to be post-COVID landscape, when you have countries that obviously that are tourist destinations, and having a Formula One Grand Prix there is a very attractive thing to get people in there. I just wonder if we're going to see this boil down to a smaller, area of focus, where to try and draw people into a specific region of the country to get those tourist bucks, that you're going to see this, like the Tuscan Grand Prix and all these Sao Paulo Grand Prix and things like that. So who knows, we might see the Texan Grand Prix for the Circuit of the Americas or whatever it might be. So that'll be an interesting kind of thing, because I mean, obviously everywhere that depends on tourism, especially where we live, is a big tourist industry, especially in the summer, in the winter as well, for winter sports and skiing, that these industries just worldwide have been hammered brutally because of COVID and all the effects that it's had on travel. So Mark, where are we now in our very ambitious, so like you said, the 23 race calendar was ambitious. We've bitten off an ambitious chunk of stories to discuss. So moving ahead, Formula One, this is just one we just need to touch on briefly. So the FIA and the teams have agreed to run a single preseason test at Bahrain that's going to run from March 12th to 14th. So we're going to have something there. So the test was originally going to be held in Barcelona a couple of weeks before that. So as soon as it looked like Australia was going to be blown off and pushed to a later date in the season, Bahrain was obviously going to be second on the calendar to begin with, and all the teams just agreed. Which in this COVID world, it finds I still find it fascinating that all the Formula One teams seem to be able to agree better on things now than they ever have in the decades and years gone past. But anyways, they decided that it would be actually make a lot more sense to have the preseason testing in Bahrain and stay there for a couple of weeks for testing and the Grand Prix. So there you go. And, being there, you're going to be guaranteed good, nice, hot, sunny weather. So that's that. Now let's move along. So now this is an interesting one, and there has been some suggestion that the regulations that were going to come in for this year that have already been pushed back once, there's some talk that perhaps they're going to be pushed back and delayed beyond 2022. But they've actually, Formula One has said this week that they're still fully 100% committed to introduce all the regulations, everything that they've tabled to put into effect for next year. That's still going to go ahead, and it's not going to be delayed for an additional year to 2023. And it really is fascinating. There was a statement that was released by the FIA and Formula One that said any suggestion that the 2022 regulations will be delayed is wrong and has not been discussed. The new regulations are designed to improve competition on the track and give our fans closer racing. This combined with the new financial regulations will improve Formula One and create a healthier and stronger business model for the whole sport, end quote. So there you go. I mean, certainly the rules and the regs surrounding the cars are supposed to, improve the racing on the track, which, of course, remains to be seen. I mean, computer models and theoretical, gains and, performances are one thing. I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, I'm not being skeptical. I just, I guess I am being skeptical to a certain degree. But what I do agree about in that statement is I think the crucial point is, especially in the world that we're living right now, are the new financial regs and everything they put into place with the cost caps and all these things, because they got to get that under control, or else some teams are going to be hurting. I mean, several of them already are.
I'll make this quick. I think there's two things at play here. One, it's the logistics of pivoting this late. Like, we have to appreciate that these teams are a significant way down the journey of developing that 2022 car. To pause that, to pivot, and then start planning a 2022 car based on the 2021 car that's based on the 2020 car would be incredibly complex. And the other piece here too is, and we always have to remember that Liberty is a publicly traded company, and their commitment to their shareholders is that they're going to deploy, to your point, this new financial model really starting this year, but accelerating next year. It would be an incredibly difficult sell for Liberty to go back to their shareholders and say, hey, we need to pause this again. We have certain commitments and we've shared certain financial models of what the sport's going to look like with this new chassis and this new car and this new subset of rules. We're going to pause it another year. I don't think they could go back to their shareholders. I think they would get crushed on the streets. My sense is the teams are far too far down the journey of developing that car. Yeah. And I also just don't think that they could go to their shareholders and basically explain that, hey, we're pushing off our revised economic model by another year. I just don't think that happens.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like you say, they're far too far down that road at the moment to delay any of these things. And like you say, it makes no sense for the fact that they've already, like, even before COVID happened, like, it was going to be a rush and it was going to be tight to get these cars designed and developed and built for 2021. So, I mean, they did get that extra breathing room and that extra time to develop these cars properly for 2022. And just to set any of those back and delay it by a year, be it, the regs for the cars or the financial side of it, just potentially opens up just a can of worms and a mess that they don't need. I mean, the thing that they need right now is that they need a stable foundation underneath them. The teams need a stable environment to work in. And, they really pushed hard for the cost cap. And again, it just blows my mind that they agreed to that. They agreed to the new Concorde agreement when typically these things dragged out over. Well, I mean, it's probably like, Game of Thrones, Bernie Ecclestone style when he was running the show in Formula One. So I'm sure there was a lot of politics involved, but, it really blew my mind that this past year, all these complex things that always seemed that just even one of them in any given year would be such a massive deal to, for all the teams to agree and come to some sort of consensus about. It was one after another after another. And certainly when it came to the cost cap, it really just came down to the numbers. Ferrari wanted a higher cost cap and kind of scaling it down, whereas you had the teams like McLaren that really wanted to shrink that number as much as possible, as soon as possible. And even after that, there was that debate. Ferrari, eventually fell into line, which is another mind-blowing event, and for me anyways. All right. Well, let's see. Where are we now? Well, we're just okay. Well, let's stick with 2022. And Mercedes says that they are facing what they're calling a formidable challenge ahead of the changes coming into effect for next year. And this seems hard to believe of a team that's won seven consecutive championships in both the drivers and constructors side. And it really is. It is interesting to hear that, because Toto Wolff, team principal, says, he's calling it's going to be what he calls, interesting year, the way that they have to structure themselves much differently that they've had to do before. And this is exactly one of your points from several weeks ago, is just because of the cost cap now. They're not going to be able to employ all these different people. They're not going to be able to spend like they have before. I mean, make no doubt about it. I mean, the best of the brightest, people are still going to end up at the top. I mean, that doesn't mean that at some of these smaller teams that the people there aren't the same. But I mean, teams like, even if they all have the same budgets, you just know because of the prestige and, everything that comes along with a team like Mercedes or Ferrari, that there's just that extra attraction for people wanting to go there. But it is interesting the way that Toto says that they're facing this formidable challenge, what he calls the slightly tweaked 2021 regulations and the big earthquake of regulatory change of 2022. I think he's brilliantly summed it up in just one sentence.
I really do love the humility that this team always demonstrates. Whether it's 2014 or 15 or 16, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you never pick up on any sense of arrogance from anyone within that organization. They're very humble. They're very cautious. They're very conservative, and they have every right to be arrogant. I think the one takeaway from this, and you made a really great point, is that as much as the cost cap is potentially going to benefit from some of the smaller and middle pack teams and their ability to be competitive, obviously there's going to be an impact to some of these greater teams. I think the one thing that a lot of people are really losing sight of is it's not just that these bigger teams are going to have less resources to invest in developing parts of the car. It's that we're just going to have more standardized parts on these cars. And if you have more standardized parts, you as a Mercedes, you don't need a team of 25 engineers and fluid aerodynamicists working 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to work on the left and right splitters on your front wing, because that's now a standardized component. So some of this cost cap and these standardized parts kind of walk lock in step with each other. But to your point as well, at the end of the day, Mercedes and Ferrari will always be the most attractive destinations for top talent in terms of recruiting engineers out of universities and from other organizations and things like that. They're never going to have an issue. It just means that the depth of their talent won't be as deep. They're not going to have those teams of 25 or 30 engineers working on specific subsets, components of the car. But at the same time, that's not necessarily going to be a requirement because you're going to see more standardized parts. And I think the hope of some of these smaller teams is like, look, having a greater number of standardized parts in kind of lockstep with a reduced spending cap is what's going to create more competitiveness and more parity. So I still believe that Mercedes is going to crush the field this year. I think what's going to be really interesting is what happens in 2022, right? Because you're already looking at a field that is predominantly powered by a Mercedes power unit. And now you're going to have these other teams that increasingly are going to have cars that are going to be fitted with components that are going to be very, very, very similar, if not identical, I guess in most cases, identical now to the Mercedes car. So 2022 is going to be awesome. I think this year is going to be more of the same, regardless of what Toto says. There's so much work that they've done over the last 5 or 6 years into this generation of car that will spill over into this coming year. And the cost cap could be $50 million, but the investments that they've made in every single year previous to this one will pay off in spades.
Yeah, I think so. You know, to be quite honest, I think by and large that the formula that we're running now that came into effect, what was it, 2017? I think by and large that it's been fairly successful. It may not have created the the wheel to wheel racing, each and every corner at each and every race all season long, but I think that the cars have been amazing to look at. I mean, the wider wings and stuff.
Yes.
It has been. I think for me, by and large, it was a step in the right direction. But I mean, this complete new paradigm shift into 2022, I mean, I think we're all sitting here with bated breath, just waiting to get to, I would presume, Melbourne, just over a year from now for the start of that season. And, like I say, all these computer models are one thing. I just can't wait to see these new cars on the track.
It's why, and you know, I've spoken about this so many times, it's why I think for Hamilton, this year is so critical because this is his opportunity to lock up that eighth title, and then he can do whatever he wants to do with his career and he'll officially be the GOAT. I just think if he doesn't win it this year, I think 2022, 23, 24, it gets increasingly complicated as he ages out and some of these younger drivers continue to develop and the parity amongst the cars gets that much closer. So I think this will be a big year for Hamilton Mercedes for sure.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, Mark, let's take another break here on the Overtime Media Network, and we're going to come back, and hopefully we're going to get away from lawsuits and talk about some other things, and we'll certainly do that right after this break, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, it's only taken us a half an hour to get into what we teased right at the start of the show, and that is the departure of Cyril Abiteboul, who is gone. He's out of Renault. I mean, he's been there for the past several years, from the transition to Lotus and into what they are now, which is Alpine. And like I was saying right off the top of the show, I can't believe we didn't pick up on it at this time last week that this just seems like it was it was in the cards, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree. I felt pretty ashamed because you and I kind of made that connection after the podcast when we were chatting on WhatsApp, and we both, it kind of struck us at the same time. I think the question really is, with Cyril Abitbol gone, what is his legacy there? And I think you and I really, and again, I don't know how we didn't think about this last week, because we were really talking about Renault's performance since 2016, right? Mm-hmm. They rejoined the sport as a works team. They kind of gobbled up the remnants of the Lotus team. They went their separate ways eventually from the Red Bull factory team. But I can't really wrap my head around, if I had to summarize their performance, it would be mediocre. It would be disappointing. It would be unexciting. Like, there was very little about this team over the last 4 or 5 years that I thought was really, I don't know. I'm struggling to articulate, if you know what I mean. Like, I just thought it was very bland. And yeah, I don't think
that was exactly the word I was going to throw out there, was bland. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think ultimately, if you ask me, did he earn the right to come back for another season? I don't think he did. And, you know, ultimately, he's responsible for the car and the driver relationship. He was the one that recruited Ricardo, which was a boon to the team. But ultimately, as we learned later, that was less about Renault and more about the fact that the divorce and the relationship with Red Bull was so bad. So I can't really credit him with that. And then the fact that Ricardo left so quickly, like, I don't think he leaves a really strong legacy. And maybe the team structurally is sound and the car is capable, but they weren't winning races in his 4 or 5 years. They had 2 podiums in the last year. Like, I don't know. I don't know what, from your perspective, like, if you had to summarize the Cyril Abitbol experience with Renault, what would you do? What would you say?
Well, you stole the words right out of my mouth when you said the word bland. But in terms of their progress in terms of improvement in competitiveness, where they are and where they should be as a manufacturer, with, you know, all the resources they have behind them, that rich history, and the fact that they've been there and they've done that, and they've got the T-shirt from what they've done in Formula One, not only as a works team but also as an engine supplier, I think that the progress under Abitbol from Lotus into Renault into Alpine, I think, can be summed up as stagnant, glacial improve, like steps forward in improvement. You know, you would kind of expect it to see a bit of an exponential curve, and it's been, I don't want to say a flat line, but it's been, you know, not what you really expect. And the fact that they finally got a couple of podiums this year, 4 or 5 years into the experiment, seems, not a great return on investment into all the money that, the parent company's been throwing into it. So, I mean, he himself feels that, he's left them with solid foundations. So that's the exact words that he used for the team, both in France and in England. And, well, perhaps operationally that is true, but just in terms of performance and results on the track, it's left a lot to be desired. I mean, I think you made a great point just now that, getting Danny Ricciardo, what was a big win for the team, but it just seemed to be a convenient landing spot for a guy that was just desperate to get out of Red Bull, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the sky's the limit potentially for this team moving forward, simply because they have this opportunity to rebrand and you've got some fresh leadership. I think one thing that's probably not being reported accurately enough is, I'm still suspect, and we'll probably get into this as we start doing our season preview shows and summarizing our expectations for the individual drivers and for the individual teams, but I think it's going to be a very challenging year if they're not successful with Alonso in that car. I just, my fear is his expectations are that he's going to be, and I know he's tried to temper expectations in the media, and he's been asked this a couple of times, and he's pressed back a little bit, indicating he's not expecting a world championship kind of competitive car in year one. But my sense is he is a very, very, I would say, anxious driver that creates a lot of anxiety and fear and friction within the garage and within the team. And I think he's going to need to be managed very closely. And I think that's ultimately what Alpine Renault were thinking when they recruited their most recent CEO, is that this is somebody that can manage that type of personality. But I think it's going to be an interesting year. But just to kind of reflect back on that Renault experience, I think it was disappointing. And to your point, like, if I'm Renault Nissan and I'm investing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in this project, and again, it's a vanity project, right? Because it's very difficult to ever extrapolate whether we sell more road cars because we have an F1 team. But if you're investing that money and the team's uncompetitive and you have a French Grand Prix, because remember, a big part of this and a big part of the investment in getting that Renault team off the ground was kind of the promise that we were going to go back to the French hinterland and have a national Grand Prix. The fact that you had a Grand Prix plus Monaco and the team's been uncompetitive has been a little bit disappointing. So in some ways, I'm kind of surprised that he had this much of a leash, to be totally honest. And I don't believe for a second that he's incompetent by any means. I think he's a good guy and he deserved the shot going back to 2016. I just think at some point you have to sever ties and reboot operation and bring in some fresh leadership. And that's obviously what they've done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that over the past several years, he's probably taken them to the place that he was capable of doing.
Yeah.
But to take it to that next step, and I mean, you can take any sport that you want to, it's not just limited to Formula One, be it a coach or a general manager or whatever it is, that sometimes you just need that guy that's going to come in and take a team that much further. Basketball, I mean, a name that immediately jumps to mind is Phil Jackson, right? I mean, look at teams in the NBA. How many titles have they won being coached by Phil Jackson, right? And how have those teams done before and after he's left that organization, right? I mean, so I don't know if Phil Jackson would be a good fit in Formula One. It would certainly be interesting.
You'd have to go and pull him out of his ranch in Montana. And I think that would be a little bit difficult to do. But be careful, because if you open up the NBA Pandora's box, I'll talk Phil Jackson for the next 3 hours. I don't know if that's what the listeners necessarily want at this point.
You know, a warning well taken, because we said right from the beginning, we've bitten off a very, very ambitious amount of topics that we wanted to cover today. Anyways, sticking with Renault, and we will pick up this Phil Jackson discussion at some point, but probably just not on the show. Anyways, Danny Ricciardo, he said this week that he feels that Renault has actually grown a little bit out of what he called a timid Formula One team, which he said was very much the environment there within the organization when he showed up there a couple of years ago. And then so that was kind of interesting. I mean, Ricciardo, I mean, he's obviously a flamboyant personality, but he's not really one of these people. He's not an Alonso, right? I mean, Alonso can be very blunt and pointed in the things that he's saying. And I don't find that a derogatory statement from Ricciardo. I feel that this year, based on their performance, that the fact that they managed to get on the podium a couple of times, I don't want to say that this is a team that has... You could go as far to say that they have like a lot of swagger now, but I think that we saw some improvements this year, because going into the season, I mean, Abita Bull really tried to temper expectations. And I think that this year there were some glimpses that things might, starting to percolate up to the surface. I think those two podiums that Ricciardo got was, I think an indication of something that the team, like I say, might not have a lot of swagger. But I think they got a bit of confidence now, and I think that that might be a good place for the new regime to start from.
That was and that was exactly Daniel Ricciardo's comment, right? Is he's being very polite and he's being very diplomatic. And of course, it's not as though his departure from Renault was something that was initiated by the team itself. This was him pursuing what he perceives to be a better opportunity, but he's obviously being very gracious and diplomatic. But that was one of the things that he had addressed, was that in his 2 years, especially as he got towards the back half of his second year, that the confidence amongst the personnel was growing by leaps and bounds. I think the one thing we really need to be cautious about, I apply this to McLaren and I apply this to Racing Point, now Aston Martin, is a lot of the results that they garnered this year were really a consequence of Ferrari's incompetence and the fact that they were, for all intents and purposes, caught cheating and were penalized in a way that really impacted their results. So again, I don't want to take any, I guess I am taking something away by making that connection. But ultimately, I think it was very much a down year for Ferrari, and a lot of these teams were able to scoop up podiums that maybe wouldn't necessarily have been available to them. But again, hopefully going forward, there'll be podiums available to everybody because we see more parity in the sport. But yeah, it'll be interesting. And the other thing that's really curious to it, and I know we're going to talk about this, is as you rebrand from Renault to Alpine, I think the changes are going to be much deeper than we're seeing. So obviously we know what's happening at the team principal level and the CEO level and the driver level. We don't typically report on changes much deeper than that. Like, we don't necessarily know what's going on with the engineers at the factory. We don't know what's going on with the mechanics in the garage and the pit crew and things like that. But my suspicion, and based on some things that I've read, is that the changes that this team are seeing are much deeper than you might expect in terms of personnel. So there's every reason to think that this isn't just kind of a rebranded team with new leadership. This will be very much fundamentally a new organization that just happens to function out of the same factory and use the same power unit that the old car did. So
yeah. Well, it's going to be one of those storylines. I mean, there's so many different fascinating stories going into 2021 and things that we're going to be watching all season long, and Renault/Alpine is definitely going to be one. And just before we head into our final break here, Mark, I don't know if everybody's seen it. I definitely go to motorsport.com, any of these fine F1 blogs that are out there, and look at the livery that Alpine's teasing for the 2021 car. Black, predominantly black, with the colors of the French flag, the red, white, and blue, and it looks like a stylized A on the back of the cowling over the engine. It looks good. I mean, Mercedes proved last year with the shift to the all black. It looks good. I think black always looks good on cars, and the addition of the colors of the French flag. If this is what they're going with, I like it. I like it a lot.
Black looks good on a car that you don't own and you don't have to maintain and you don't have to polish and wax and clean. But I was unimpressed, to be honest. Like, I woke up this morning, opened my social, because I think that's what people do, right? You open your eyes and you open Instagram, see what's happening.
Pretty much.
That's what I did. It was one of the first things that popped up in my feed. And it's just like, it's okay. But I was talking to my buddy Randy, and I'm just going to quote out of WhatsApp here. I was unexpectedly, he really liked it. And his quote is, "It has a clean, no BS, almost sinister vibe. Satin black is done to death, but throwing the tricolor on there is like an athlete draping themselves in their country flag on the podium." I'm like, yeah, that's actually a really great way to summarize. Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
and I think what's really important for people to understand is that Alpine is deeply embedded in French motorsport culture. And that's what that tricolor represents, is the French national flag. And if I'm a French motorsport fan, I can get behind this more than I can that weird kind of metallic yellowy colored Renault thing that we saw the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah. If I'm a French motorsport fan, this is awesome, and I'm going to buy all the merch associated with this car.
Yeah, well, maybe that's a lot to do with it. It might not look, some people might be kind of love it or hate it. I mean, me and your friend Randy, I think we're obviously guys that like it. You're, a little bit lukewarm on it. But I mean, the thing that it does, it might really play into, it might look really good in a lot of the merch and hats and t-shirts and jackets and things like that. So anyways, it looks good. I like it. And we'll see. I'm looking, this is the exciting part of the year, because, you're just weeks away from the car launches as you get into February and March and stuff like that. So, I mean, this is one team we're going to be looking at. And another one that we're going to be looking forward to is Aston Martin. And we're actually going to talk about Aston Martin. We're going to do so just on the other side of the break here. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a very short moment.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. For all of you watching on YouTube, the podcast listeners, we're still here. We're still running down the latest news, and we're going to talk a little bit now about Aston Martin. And well, this is, you know, I think something we touched on again a couple of weeks ago, but team principal Otmar Szafnauer says that he believes that four-time world champion Sebastian Vettel is going to bring out the best in his young teammate and our fellow Canadian Lance Stroll. And certainly, like we said, was it last week or the week before, Mark, that with everything that that Lance has around him now at Aston Martin, if he doesn't put it all together in the next year or so, you got to think that he's never going to be able to figure it out in Formula One.
I'm feeling really good about the last five or six shows because we seem to pick up on these stories and these trends long before the media does. So when the stories come to us, we're always able to reflect on the fact that, yeah, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, but we absolutely talked about this, and we talked about it in the vein that bringing Vettel into the team is a marketing exercise because you can sell the team based on the fact that you have a world champion in your cockpit, but also because, and there's no question here, that Lawrence justifiably wants to do everything he can to develop Lance as a driver. And what better way to do that than partnering him with a Formula One world champion that's been to the top of the mountain four times? And I think Vettel's personality is such that he's probably somebody that is going to be a very good teammate and share data and share intel and share best practices. And I'm sure in the process of contract negotiations, it was probably made pretty clear to him that, hey, look, as much as we're bringing you in to be a competitive driver, to give you the opportunity to win races, we also need you to help develop this young driver that's going to be in the cockpit next to you. Because people always forget that Lance is 21. He's a baby. He seems like he's been in the sport forever, but he's still so young. And I think partnering him with Vettel is going to be very, very significant for his career. Because again, it was great that he was with Perez, but Perez didn't win his first race as a driver until last season. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The partnerships in Williams were problematic for all the reasons that we've ever spoken about. But now he gets to go into that garage every race weekend with a world champion. He gets to sit in debriefs with a world champion and watch video with a world champion. I think this is going to be fantastic for Lance's development. And I think that's really what Otmar was speaking to in the piece that you described. But I think absolutely this is going to be very significant for Stroll's development.
Yeah, well, Otmar was saying that he believes that the two of them, they're going to play off each other and motivate each other. That's that's what Szafnauer is saying. And certainly, and the thing that's interesting about Stroll is I find compared to other drivers of his age group, you know, thinking about the Maxes, the Charles, the Landos, and your George Russells, that I find that Lance is, he's much more in talent-wise, his talent is more raw. And I find that, I keep thinking, being in the organization that he is now, having everything that he has around him now, can they take that piece of coal and polish it up and find that diamond underneath? Because, despite that, all the success that Lance has had in the lower formulas, we've seen glimpses of it. I don't want to, put him down because I'm not trying to do that at all. Unfortunately, he just gets a lot of criticism. I think, unfairly, he gets painted with that brush. He's only there because he's got a rich dad, which, I mean, obviously that's true to an extent, but there's more to it than that. So I genuinely believe that Lance has talent, and it's just watching over the next year or so to see how that talent, is it going to really come out and present itself, or is he going to stay more or less where he is right now? So very, very interesting. And again, we were talking about before the break that there's so many great storylines to watch in 2021. And this whole Aston Martin thing absolutely fascinates me. I would say it's to the point of obsession, but it's certainly getting there. I mean, there's just so many things to watch. I mean, there's so many things to watch in Formula One, but this team in particular, there's a lot going on because, I mean, there was certainly a lot of, indications this year that there's something happening with this team. And now with the additional investment, you got Vettel there, you're going into the new new factory, all the money, all the Stroll bucks that are coming in into this team. It just, you know, it just, like I said, you know, I've said a couple of times over the past month or so, this doesn't feel like a vanity project. It feels like a bunch of people that are serious about coming into Formula One, and they're serious about competing. And obviously being serious about competing means winning races and winning championships. So, you know, to put it in a nutshell, that's why I'm excited about watching this team.
Absolutely. And we have absolutely, I think, sprayed champagne all over Lawrence Stroll for the past part of the last 2 or 3 months, really, because, you know, we talk about the fact that Force India went into administration, which was triggered by Sergio Perez, and it was the right thing to do. But there were a couple of groups that were looking to bid on that team. And oftentimes when a company goes into administration in the UK, other companies bid on them because they want to strip them for parts. And Lawrence has done absolutely the opposite, in the sense he has invested hundreds of millions of dollars to turn what was really a capable but kind of, and I'd say, financial weakling of an F1 team into potentially a powerhouse. He invested in the team, and then he went out and spent hundreds of millions of dollars investing in Aston Martin so that he could marry the two and create a works team. Like, what he's done is absolutely exceptional, and he deserves all the praise in the world. He's done it the right way. He's invested the money. He's built the facilities. He's brought in the right personnel. I have nothing but praise for this guy. And I think it just, the win this season just really reinforced that the things that he's doing are the right things. And again, you said it, I'll say it, I can't wait to see what this team has for 2021.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be one of those fascinating stories to watch, you know, going into this season. So this is another story that we've talked about basically since Bahrain 2 Secure Grand Prix. But George Russell's now kind of downplaying the possibilities of getting a seat at Mercedes for 2022. He hasn't completely ruled it out, saying that that situations and things can change quite quickly in Formula One. But, you know, just seeing what he did, and just knowing at the age that he's at, knowing where Lewis is in his career, I just feel that, and the fact that he already is a Mercedes driver, even though he's, racing for Williams. I mean, to me, he just checks off too many boxes in the pros column to bring this guy into Mercedes, as a potential, I don't want to say replacement for Lewis, but certainly, if you've got, you're looking at a post Lewis Hamilton Mercedes team, you have to think that you want to bring in the next guy that might be there after Lewis leaves. I mean, he might not want to leave for another 5 or 6 years, who knows, right? But you have to think at some point it's going to really pay off to bring in a young driver, specifically a hot prospect like George Russell, and give him that opportunity of having a couple of years at least with a guy like Lewis Hamilton to learn what it's all about and to absorb everything of being around a guy like Lewis Hamilton is going to benefit and teach a guy like George Russell.
I feel like I start every paragraph with the following. We've talked about this so much in the past, but I think the risk here to George Russell is that we know he's under contract with Williams this year. We don't necessarily know what the contract status is going to look like for the two Mercedes drivers for 2022. My concern for him is that the drum will start beating early in the season from the media about where he's going to be in 2022. And my fear for him is that this could be personally a distraction, in the sense that he's going to start wondering. I think it's going to be a distraction for the team, because I think the team's going to be asked about it a lot. I think it's going to be a distraction from the Mercedes team, because we all know that that should be the end destination. But if it's going to be the case for 2022, I hope it's addressed in season, publicly and internally, because my fear is that it's going to be a distraction. And the other piece too is that if I'm George Russell and it's not addressed in season, and we wait till after the season, where am I from a confidence perspective? 3 years with Williams is a really tough grind with a team that simply doesn't have the capability to feel the competitive team. I think for his well-being, if you're long-term objective is to get him into that car, you need to let him know sooner than later. And that needs to be a mid-season decision. And I think to your point, part of this needs to be that We know that Lewis isn't going to race forever. He's in his mid-30s, especially if he wins the championship this year. There's absolutely no necessary motivation for him to come back as a 36, 37, 30-year-old driver. Like, the urgency for me, if I'm Toto and Daimler, is I need to get this kid into the car, because for the same reasons that Lance needs to be next to Vettel, you want this guy soaking up as much as possible from Lewis before he ultimately exits the sport. And you don't want to rob him of that opportunity. The other thing that's really advantageous to Mercedes here is that, one, George Russell's a young kid and he's British. And, you know, we talk about Mercedes being a German company. It's a British racing team. The power unit's developed in the UK. The team is based out of Brackley. For all intents and purposes, this is a British team. And the marketing potential of having him in this team for the next 5 or 10 years, especially since he's so charismatic and he's so photogenic, like, you want to be able to leverage those marketable assets and capabilities of this driver. I just hope that this isn't something that becomes a distraction as the season winds on. Do you know what I mean?
That's
ultimately my fear, is that come Canada, all we're talking about is, where's Russell going to be next year? Where's Russell going to be next year? And if Bottas is struggling or isn't competitive with Hamilton, that drumbeat only gets faster and faster and faster.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting too, because I was thinking about the incident that he had behind the safety car at Imola, where he put it in the safety wall or into the crash barriers when he was trying to keep his tires warm. You know, that to me was an unfortunate thing. You know, it was a young driver that wasn't used to something like that. It was one of those things, you know. And then I thought, well, I felt really bad for him, because there's that picture on Instagram, you know, sort of sitting there, you know, with his head in his hands. And then you got the double whammy, because you got Roman Grosjean saying, "Don't worry, mate, it happens to the best of us." You know, it's just like, I don't know if I want to be consoled about crashing into the wall behind a safety car, but, you know, by the likes of Roman Grosjean. But that's a different story. But, you know, that was one of those things. I had thought about it after the season, and though, especially after Sakhir, that this would be a guy that would just, I think, would just soak up like that being in that environment, being in that team, you know, and being teammate to a guy like Lewis Hamilton. I just think that there are just so many upsides bringing him in to that team, because if you wait another year or beyond, then at some point he just knows that despite being in the Mercedes system, it just, you know, ultimately does not funnel up to the big team. And then he's one day, you know, he's going to say, you know what, guys, you know, just, you know, get me out of here. I want to go to Renault or Alpine. I want to go to Red Bull or, you know, whatever it might be. And, you know, these links to Mercedes, you know, very much like Esteban Ocon had, right, a couple of years ago. You know, he could very much kind of find himself a little bit hindered that, you know, what seems a great situation to be, you know, in that Mercedes system ultimately becomes a bit of a shackle that, you know, limits you and your opportunities elsewhere. So
why do you think Mercedes is so invested in retaining Bottas in that seat? Is it simply because it's a formula that's working and it's propelling Hamilton to championships and is propelling them to constructors championships, and there's no reason to disrupt that formula? Why do you think there's hesitation for Mercedes to make what seems like such a logical move to all of us?
Well, it is interesting, right? And I guess familiarity breed, breeds comfort, and certainly, like you say, that system, that formula works. That they know what they're going to get out of Valtteri Bottas. They know that he's going to deliver points. He's going to win a handful of races each and every year, which kind of keeps him happy. And I guess there is that perpetual discussion that he's a challenger. You know, I'm using the inverted commas here, that he's a challenger in the title race with Lewis. Although in reality, I think that's obviously disputed. But certainly, I think that Sakhir was interesting, because I think it plants a seed about in some people's mind about, like, how good is Lewis? Is it, you know, how good is he, or is it all just the car? And I mean, I think obviously Lewis Hamilton is an exceptionally good Formula One driver, but I think what George Russell did in that one weekend, and of course it's a very small sample, you know, just getting in there for a couple of practice sessions, a qualifying and a race, you know, to really start to drawing comparisons with Lewis Hamilton. But I think it's really posed some interesting questions. I think the first one is, is could he do what Valtteri Bottas is doing, but do it better? And I think my answer to that is, I think he could. And I think the only question or doubt I have about him at this time is not his capabilities as as a race driver. I think it comes down to a little bit more a question about experience, his racecraft and also consistency. I think those are the questions. I think those are, maybe a couple of the marks against George Russell right now, but that's an age thing. That's an experience thing. And, you're never going to, I think it purely comes down to experience in Formula One, because let's face it. I think he knows he's a good driver. I think we have all recognized that, that potentially there could be something special there. And a guy like that, I think ultimately he's not going to be, satisfied in Williams unless miraculously they really figure it out and develop a competitive car, which seems like a bit of a stretch.
I kind of draw a parallel to my early snowboarding days, and my sense is that he has nothing more to learn as a driver in that car because of the limitations of that vehicle. And I reflect back on when I first got into snowboarding, I was really hesitant to move on to a yellow run. So when you're on a mountain, you've got your green runs and you've got your yellow runs and you've got your red runs. I spent weeks and weeks and weeks on a green run because I'm not ready. And I finally came to this realization that I can spend all the time in the world on a green run, but my skill set is never going to improve. And I learned more one day on a yellow run than I did in the prior 2 weeks playing on the green runs. And I just think in his case, his growth is capped at that team. And I think he personally will probably recognize that, and he probably does already. But I just think if his future is not defined by the end of the season, I think there's going to be some frustration there and there's going to be some friction in that relationship. So hopefully there's something that works for all parties, minus Bottas, because I think ultimately he's going to be the one that doesn't kind of have a seat at the end of this. But I'm eager to see him in that car. But just know that if he's in that car, he's not going to be in that car to be a 1B driver, right? Like, he's going to be there with the expectation that he's going to have the opportunity to win races and compete for world championships. And again, I think that's probably strategically one of the reasons why Mercedes has kind of put a pause on this. Like, hey, you know what? The formula that we have now is working. Hamilton's happy. He's winning titles. With Bottas, we're winning constructors. There's nothing left for us to achieve. And I just think that after this season, there may be less hesitation to meddle with that formula, especially if Hamilton's got that eighth title. But we'll have to see.
Yeah, it could really sort of, let's just say that if he came in, he really flipped the team on its head and, turned out to be as quick or quicker than Lewis Hamilton. Certainly, that could tarnish his legacy a little bit. So perhaps, there is something to that. I mean, of course, this is pure speculation.
And what we do best.
Oh yeah, of course, it's what we do best. And we're basing this off one weekend in the desert in the Middle East. And it certainly, if anything else, it has provoked what I think to be a fascinating line of thought. And again, only time will tell and see where it goes. But ultimately, I think that they have to make a decision on what they want to do with George Russell. Do they want to keep him within the Mercedes family, or are they going to, sever those ties and let him, find his own way in Formula One and let his career lead where it's ultimately going to lead? All right, Mark. So one more story that I want to cover before we wrap it up. And this is one that you sent me earlier this year. So we kind of started the show on uncertainty and things that might be up in the air. And we're going to go right back to that. And that is the potential that perhaps Alfa Romeo may not be sticking around in Formula One much longer.
Yeah. And I think you need to be careful with the story, because as is a lot of web generated content, it's a little bit misleading. And you read into the story, and the report is that Alfa Romeo's time in Formula One could be short-lived. And I think you need to be careful and kind of peel that title away a little bit, because ultimately, Alfa Romeo isn't really a traditional works team, nor is the Alfa Romeo team actually owned by Fiat. This is really just a really deep, elaborate sponsorship agreement with Sauber. So there's some things happening at the corporate level right now. We're in the process of witnessing a Fiat Peugeot merger, which will potentially create a mega company called, and I think it's pronounced Stellantis or Stellantis. But ultimately, one of the consequences of this is that Fiat, who is the owner of the Alfa Romeo brand, may abandon this project because this is very much just an elaborate sponsorship. Now, it yes. doesn't mean that the team is going to potentially leave the grid. It's just that the Alfa Romeo branding associated with this team may evaporate. And Sauber's had an interesting history, right? Like if you move back a couple of decades ago, Sauber has historically been, regardless of who the ownership is, an independent Swiss-based Formula One team. At some point in the early 2000s, the team was actually bought by BMW and rebranded BMW Sauber. They had a fairly short-lived, unsuccessful run, and the team was actually bought back by the original owner. So they bought back the equity that BMW had invested in the team, and they became Sauber. They had a pretty mediocre run for the next decade, and then ultimately the tie-up with Ferrari happened, and then the sponsorship deal with Alfa Romeo happen. So if you see this, if you hear from this, it's really just a potential consequence of the merger between Peugeot and Fiat in that some of these vanity projects may have to disappear as a consequence of the current state of the global economy. But that doesn't mean that Sauber itself will disappear. But it could mean that Sauber, who is deeply, deeply reliant on these sponsorship deals, may eventually come on the market for sale. And I think that is the potential outcome of this is Sauber owns the team, but they are completely dependent on the dollars associated with this deeply embedded sponsorship. And if the sponsorship goes away and it's not easily replaced, the team itself may be for sale. And we don't see Formula One teams up for sale very often. And given that there's only 10 of them, there could be some real interest. The hope, of course, is that the Mazepin family stays as far away from this team as possible. We don't need any part of them owning a Swiss-based Formula One team.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Yeah, it certainly is one that's food for thought, and I think you summed it up perfectly that the speculation is a little bit misleading that if they're going to pull out the sport, and again, I think you summed it up perfectly in the fact that it is they're not the team. It is, like you say, a very elaborate sponsorship deal, because I mean, what was it a couple of years ago? It was Sauber, then Alfa Romeo Sauber, and then it's been Alfa Romeo the last couple
of
years.
You got it.
Yeah. I mean, it looks great to see it on the car. I mean, it looks really good when it's out on the track there, but it is just, for more or less, it is just a fancy, paint scheme and decals on the side of the car, but still it would be a little bit of a loss, and certainly there would be a bit of a concerning vacuum for Sauber themselves should they decide to pull out. So who knows, and it kind of makes you wonder if perhaps some of these other names that that we hear associated with Formula One, would another manufacturer be interested to pick that up and do something with it? I mean, you just made that that great reference to BMW Sauber in the early 2000s. I mean, could we see possibly like a Volkswagen or an Audi or a Porsche, or I guess technically some of them fall under the same corporate umbrella, but could you see, another big mega auto company jumping in and buying this team and rebranding it as one of those, really well-known, brands, right? So certainly, another one that we're just going to have to watch, because the way that things change in this in the world nowadays, certainly something that you didn't really see on the radar a week ago all of a sudden becomes a thing, and it's a real big issue this week. So this one, there could be something to it, so we'll just have to follow up in the weeks and months ahead. And with that, Mark, I think that we've come to the end of our equivalent of a very ambitious 23 race season in podcast form. I don't know if we covered 23 stories. It certainly feels like it. But, that's all I got this week. And I think the way that you're starting to organize things on your side, put your notes back, that you've pretty much run out of things to say as well.
A news anchor at the desk. I'll put away, for the sake of our listeners, I'll put away my 3 pages of MotoGP corner notes. I'll save that for next week.
There you go. Well, I guess we're going to need like a good sign off now, like stay classy, San Diego. You know, maybe we need Ron Burgundy on the show, but or maybe not. But anyways, that's it from us this week, guys. Thank you very much for downloading, listening, and watching the show on YouTube. If you want to get in touch, by all means, do so on Twitter at ScooteryF1Pod and also on email at ScooteryF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's a wrap. It's been a real rip doing the show. Anyways, it's a wrap. Thanks for hanging out with us. And we'll talk to you guys again this time next week. Bye for now.